Good evening, everyone, and welcome to a Fireside Chat with Zany Mystic. I am your host, Lance White. Tonight's guest is Paul Von Ward. Paul is the author of The Soul Genome, Science and Reincarnation, written from the perspective of a psychologist and interdisciplinary cosmologist. Before becoming an independent scholar and creator of the reincarnation experiment, Paul's public career included roles as a Protestant minister, U.S. naval officer, American diplomat, U.S. State Department official, and the founder, CEO of Delphi International. So let's welcome Paul to the show now. Hi, thank Paul. How are you?
Doing very well, thank you. Delighted to be with you.
Oh, good, good, good. Now you've got me curious. I had a question to ask you to start out with.
Oh, good.
When I saw Delphi International, I thought, well, what is Delphi International anyway?
Well, Delphi International is not the big international corporation that makes automobile parts.
I hope not.
It was a small nonprofit that some colleagues and I founded in 1980.
Uh-huh.
And I was the active founder and CEO of that organization for about 12 or 15 years. It was created to be a international exchange, cultural improvement, peace activist, international corporation kind of organization.
Sounds wonderful.
It was built on something of the model, you know, the Fulbright program, which State Department has had for so many years. I used to be the Deputy Director for Policy and Plans of that program, and also other programs of citizen diplomats, track to diplomacy. So we were very active in the 80s in Soviet American affairs from the citizen private sector level, and also in the late 80s and early 90s in Sino-American affairs with China's opening up. And in all, during that 15 years, we were involved in 100 countries in various projects of one kind or the other, bringing professionals to the United States, sending our folks overseas, doing training programs, development programs, and that sort of thing.
Wonderful. Now, you're also the creator of the reincarnation experiment, and that kind of segues into your latest book, which is The Soul Genome, The Science and Reincarnation. What is the reincarnation experiment? How did that start?
Well, it started several years ago when I had started some research on a book that was meant to be sort of a historical, philosophical look at reincarnation and karma and transformation, those themes.
Uh-huh.
And it was meant to be sort of not an academic book, but a book that, looked at a sort of array of sources and just synthesizing the views of a lot of people and what they might mean.
Mm-hmm.
But in the middle of that project, and I have been interested in the idea of reincarnation for, 25 years
mm-hmm.
or so, I guess. And back in the early 90s, I'd met Ian Stevenson, this very well-known psychiatrist who worked for 40-something years at the University of Virginia developing research data on reincarnation cases involving children and their memories and physical features and so on.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But during the course of this book that I was writing, I began to do a meta-analysis of a lot of cases that had been published by a variety of people.
Hmm.
Plus all the work that Stevenson and his successor, Jim Tucker, have done at the University of Virginia. And I realized as I started looking at these cases, like those of us who are older used to make presentations by using an overhead projector by laying one transparency on top of the other to make a total picture when you got all the pieces together.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, as I went through these cases and started sorting out the data, what was the empirical evidence that people were reporting about possible reincarnation cases?
Uh-huh.
And I found several categories of data. Physical features that seemed to be very similar with the past life that had been identified as a possible past life of an individual.
Uh-huh.
Ways that these people, both past and present, thought alike.
Uh-huh.
Their minds, their mental working. Also, their emotional profile, if you please.
Mm-hmm.
And with my psychological background, I've always been interested in development theory from the days of Reed and Gordon Alport and Gardner and Skinner and others. And those theories were never very satisfactory to explain how we as unique individuals grow out of a culture or a particular family or environment. Because you see, the traditional theories implied that we were sort of a tabula rasa, a blank slate that started out at childhood, you know, with some genetic predispositions and so on, but basically a lump of clay for society to develop.
To brainwash.
To brainwash, to conditioning. Well, right. You know, Skinner's notion of conditioning, it was stimulus and response.
Oh, absolutely.
So on. But, you know, when you started actually looking at real people and looking at the environment from which they developed, it didn't match. You know, individuals became themselves, unique individuals. So in the middle of this reincarnation case meta-analysis little project, I began to see a whole personality for people emerge out of what appeared to be past life experiences. And so then I said, wait a minute. You know, this is something different than anybody has talked about in terms of reincarnation. It's not some ethereal, spiritual phenomenon. It's not some thing that results in a few past life memories or a traumatic experience in a lifetime that somebody can get relief by engaging in reincarnation or regression therapy. It's a package that if it's real, if reincarnation is a real phenomenon in this natural universe of ours, it is really a legacy that we're all born with that predisposes not only the way we look and our physical genotypical features, it also predisposes the way we think, the way we act, the way we feel, the way we interact with other people, the creative choices that we take, and on and on. It was a total personality model. And what I found was that Ian Stevenson and Jim Tucker at the University of Virginia, some other people who'd written their own cases, like a man named Jeffrey Keane, who researched himself as a reincarnation of a Confederate soldier, and other books, and some books written by people that I knew who'd been published by one of my publishers, Hampton Roads in Charlottesville, and Walter Simcoe, who had looked at a number of cases and found some general similarities, and he had not, you know, developed them as a comprehensive model, but he had the data there. And another book published by the same publisher was focused on the case of Marilyn Monroe.
Oh, yeah.
Possible reincarnation in this lifetime, by the which it's going to be the subject of a documentary film that we're working on this next 2 weeks. Showing the psychiatric perspective on that case and past life regression, hypnosis, and so on, and then my empirical psychophysical research. Anyhow, looking at those cases, I began to see that what seemed to have happened in earlier stages of reincarnation research is that different people obviously looked at the phenomenon from their own particular perspective. And so we had, like, the 12 blind men feeling the elephant.
They
were writing books and so on from their own background.
Right.
And as an interdisciplinary cosmologist, I, as you know from my earlier books, I look at all disciplines, you know. I say, let's look at all of the perspectives on a particular topic or a particular question. And so I was bringing a psychological perspective and that interdisciplinary perspective to reincarnation research. And I said, you know, there's something going on here that is a very comprehensive phenomenon in terms of who we are and what we are and how we live our lives. So the reincarnation experiment was an effort to then get other people involved, looking at their own cases, working together to apply this psychophysical model that's described in the Soul Genome book, and to see if we can validate this concept. And so I wrote the book then as the sort of pilot study phase of the experiment ended, you know, we had enough cases to demonstrate that it seemed to be very reliable in distinguishing between what might be a very strong reincarnation case and a case that just doesn't hold up when you look at the details.
Mm-hmm.
And so the book presented the model, and it describes a number of cases, some very extensively and others just in sort of examples from different chapter to the other. And then when the book came out, then I had collected a number of people around, literally around the world, in Croatia and Russia and China, not in China, in Canada, Australia, the United States, the UK, and so on, who were interested in this sort of approach. And so we've been, you know, exchanging cases and discussing them and putting some on the website. So we now have a website called the Reincarnation Experiment, and it's just www.reincarnationexperiment.org.
Mm.
And these cases are evolving. And what's happening, of course, is that, you know, we're finding that some of the things that we thought were solid in the pilot study may not hold up. Other things we're learning that we have to add to the model.
Huh.
But it's an ongoing process, and a number of people are collaborating with me on it and doing different, you know, aspects of analysis of various cases, and we're sharing the data. And we're inviting individuals, you know, to look at their own cases, because in my perspective, it doesn't really change your life much if you go to a psychic and say, you know, tell me who I was in a past life, and they, you know, said, well, you were an aide to Napoleon in the Battle of Waterloo. Well, you know, what does that tell you?
No.
Or you were Cleopatra, and you feel good because, gee, I was a great queen, and so on. Those kinds of experiences, you know, sort of are titillating, but they don't have meaning for one's day-to-day living. And the same thing with regression therapy, which, you know, has been developed quite well over the last 30 years, where people are able to, who have some psychological hang-ups or psychophysical symptoms of one kind or the other, or issues that they haven't been able to resolve in this lifetime, and through regression therapy, through hypnotic recovery of some alleged past life memories, have sort of a cathartic experience, and they, you know, get better, as Roger Wilger said, you know, about 20 years ago when he stumbled onto this technique in the late 70s, early 80s. And so that's a, you know, an aspect of reincarnation research, but it really has, it's very narrow.
Right.
And a lot of the data that comes out of those sessions, you can't really test them anyway. You can't really validate them. So it doesn't ring true, you know, to the person or to other people in many, many cases, or in most cases. So what we found out is that if people get involved in their own research, and that's what the research experiment website and the book and the process that we've developed helps people do.
Have
so that's a long answer to your question. I'm sorry about that.
That's just fine. It actually, it covers, you covered a lot of ground there. Are you finding that there's a time lapse between incarnations, or does it vary on the person that's reincarnating? And what might be some of the karmic reasons why somebody might come back again?
Okay, let me take that question in two parts.
Okay.
One, in terms of timing, you know, we don't really know, because we don't have a database of a million people.
Right.
You know, to say I've got a statistical average that says that it's this amount of time or that. So what we have is sort of anecdotal material and a look at the different researchers. And Ian Stevenson, actually, intuitively, from the data that he picked up early on, suggested that lives that ended abruptly, you know, through accidents, through murder, through various reasons that, you know, were unexpected, that those soul genomes, I call them a psychoplasm because it's, you know, it's not something ethereal. It is it's a bioenergetic information field that encompasses the actual physical genome. So it's more than DNA.
Oh, okay.
But anyhow, so when that is aborted in a lifetime, it seems to come back much more quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's a child, it can be very quick. But for older people who have reached sort of what I would call the end of a developmental cycle, you know, who have had this process of maturation and assimilation and integration of experience in this lifetime, seem to not appear again very quickly. It may be decades. It may even be a century or more. And so it's hard to say, but I think you see this sort of spectrum, you know. And I think it may have something to do with the nature of the being's developmental evolution and process of maturation. Because what seems to be happening here, and this gets to your karmic question, what seems to be happening is that reincarnation is really a natural part of all living species reproduction processes. In other words, it's something that occurs at all in all species. And I'm talking about, you know, from the single cell on up to the humans and more advanced beings than we are. So what function it seems to carry out for the universe, for the consciousness of our universe, and I guess you know from my other writing, I believe that the universe is a self-conscious, self-learning organism, you know.
And yes, that was from the Solarian legacy, wasn't
that
it?
That goes back to the our Solarian legacy and Solarian legacy concept that
we're
more than mere Earthlings and Solarians. We are cosmic beings who arise from the quantum plenum of consciousness that seems to be the underpinning of all the matter and energy and entities in the universe. So anyhow, that's a whole other question and issue. But if you have this kind of universe, you see, it would be very wasteful if it had species in it that just sort of were born and died individually and had no way of preserving the conscious evolution of the species. I'm not talking about just physical evolution. I'm talking about the conscious evolution of the species. So reincarnation is the process by which the universe seems to ensure that the learning that takes place in all species has a way of carrying forward as a legacy to succeeding generations. It's very interesting because, you know, back at the time of Darwin, there was really a competition between two concepts at that time. Darwin, who looked at it from a very physical point of view, but there was Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, another scientist, who felt at the time that it was not only mutations and adaptations at the physical level. He thought that species carried forward learning, adaptation in terms of experience, that was carried forward too. And in the you know, the scientific culture of the times, over 150 years ago, there was not as much support for Lamarck, or he wasn't as good a person marketing his ideas as was Darwin, and it didn't catch on. But I think that his bigger concept, more comprehensive notion of what's involved in the process of reincarnation, is correct. And what we're doing in this research experiment is we're validating that that broader concept is the way things work, and it has a purpose.
And that also,
purpose is not some magical karmic kind of process. The original meaning of the word karma in Sanskrit meant simply the effects of action, the consequences of decisions. And it seems to me that's the way it works. We've developed a, you know, a sort of a mystical idea that, you come back and you get judged, and or you judge yourself and you get punished in the next lifetime for what you didn't do right in the last lifetime and so on. Or you have something that needs to be changed to improve the perfection of your soul. Those are terms that, while they sound good, you know, and
yeah.
they resonate with our spiritual traditions, they don't really describe much.
Yeah, yeah.
And what we're finding in the reincarnation experiment is that you can describe this process, and if you look at case after case, you see that the legacy that a person died with, as it were, that is the result of the experiences and learning and development of that particular lifetime, plus all that came before, is then carried forward as a legacy.
Yes, yes, that makes a lot of sense.
To still be worked on.
And, you know, that would also explain the number of child prodigies that exist. They're just, you know, from ages of 1, 2, and 3 are picking up violins and playing piano and, you know, doing all kinds of things that would take many lifetimes to learn.
Absolutely. Well, this, what I've tried to do in the book, and you picked up on one of the themes, is I've tried to look at the other areas of evidence for reincarnation that are not regularly associated with the idea of reincarnation. So I say that everyone is precocious. Precocious means we are born with things that we have not yet learned in this lifetime.
Okay.
So prodigies are just a little more extreme on that continuum, but all of us have prodigious or precocious skills and talents that we bring with us. In other words, if you look at any child, there is some area or the other or many areas that you see the child doing, competent in, behaving in a fashion, knowing something, learning something, doing something, saying something, behaving in a way that you say, that's an old soul. Look at that. They're really ahead of their peers. But all of us are, in one way or the other. And so,
you mean in spite of our appearances,
heart, this notion of what we're doing in the reincarnation experiment, I don't want to say that we've got the final answer here, or that we're absolutely certain, because I don't think our scientific tools are that good dealing with such a subject at this point in time. But assuming that we're on the right track, this concept and this orientation to past life legacies predisposing the current life, you know, in a particular direction, will change the way parents raise their children in modern society, will change the whole concept of education, will change the way we think about the people that we work with, that we live with, that we love, that we are interacting with in both positive and negative ways. You know, we are all acting out and carrying forward the past that we brought with us, obviously learning in this lifetime. I mean, that's the process. But if we fail to learn very much, the consequence is the soul genome of that person, the psychoplasm that incarnates in another being, and it's going to start off where we left off.
So in a sense, nothing is wasted.
Nothing is wasted.
But if one doesn't use the opportunities to, or goes backwards.
Right.
If one makes bad choices, then it's like a record player that's dug a groove in a little deeper.
That's right.
And one might be more inclined towards violence or negativity or some kind of negative social behavior.
Sure. I mean,
unless you make choices then that take you out of that.
Right, unless you make choices as an individual and unless the environment in which you develop is conducive.
Right.
To that. So that's why we have a collective responsibility, you know, as a society, to think about the individuals who are born into that society. We know they're coming with various predispositions, and what we have to do is to, as older souls, look at the new people and see where they're headed. Not try to force them, not try to hammer them into one direction or the other. One form or the other. And some of them will need help to do things differently this time. You know, so rather than jumping on them and punishing them and trying to condition them things ought to be, we need to help them unfold in a constructive way by understanding and supporting the other areas of their soul legacy.
Oh, absolutely.
So anyhow, that's the take I have on it. And so from my, let's see, I was first studying development theory and psychology courses, almost 50 years ago. So what I'm seeing after at least 45 years, this sort of journey of my own coming full circle, you know, not being satisfied with that set of psychological theories that were, too narrow in their thinking and based more on intellectual theorizing than actual data.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, this is coming full circle, and I'm seeing a totally new and different way of thinking about the development of an individual's personality in a particular lifetime.
Well, of course, it seems in this particular world that we're in, it seems like everybody's kind of doing their own thing, and there really is not much unity in this dualistic society that we live in.
That's right.
There's a great deal of corruption and greed that's oppressing everybody. And maybe you have a view coming from your more spiritual aspects, having been involved with the ministry years ago. Maybe you have another view on what's going on today from that view. Well, you know.
Well, I do. You see, because I have evolved over time. I started out, of course, in my youth as a young minister, more or less taking the traditional Protestant fundamentalist orientation, because that was the culture that I had been born in. But I was challenging it even from my teen age years. And so what's happened, and so I sort of quickly got out of that worldview. As I got into science and psychology and so academic studies and to getting out into the professional world and, you know, getting out into the big world at large, as you described earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I've done then over the years, and I think one of my next, probably the second book from the next one, is going to be a book on what I call natural spirituality. Because I think the supernaturalism and the mysticism that infuses our current religions and sort of New Thought, New Age communities, lacks the grounding, you know, in the scientific realm, in the empirical realm. And I think that what we're doing is not merging the two of them, but that we are changing both of them.
No question about that.
And so that's why I'm calling it natural spirituality.
Oh, that sounds interesting.
So
well, you
anyhow,
know, science is almost becoming mysticism. It's
well,
evolving
no,
so rapidly.
No, I don't want to use that word. Because mysticism, you see, is, once again, the root is myth. And what we want to get away from is the creation of myths.
Right, right.
By projecting our own wishes, desires,
right.
fears, hopes, aspirations.
Right. And creating.
And grounding them in the experiences that we have and learning better how that fits into the overall nature of a naturally evolving conscious universe.
Well, that
so
makes
anyhow,
sense.
One of the other things that I spend a lot of time on is looking at words and how words affect the psychology of the being.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I've done this work on worldviews and anyone who goes to my website can take their own self-assessment of a worldview questionnaire to sort of see how they fit in with other people's worldviews.
Tell us what your website is now so we
It's www.vonward.com. That's my, you know, my professional website, which is separate from the Reincarnation Experiment, which is, has its own website, but that's reincarnationexperiment.org, all one word, Reincarnation Experiment.
Now, you also do research.
There's overlap, of course, between my work in both these areas, but the vonward.com is sort of my collection of, you know, books and papers and things that I've done over time, and an overall perspective. Whereas the Reincarnation Experiment is really focusing on the empirical testing of this psychoplasm model for reincarnation legacies.
Now, you also have some interesting thoughts on multiple dimensions.
Yeah, you know, this is another place where we have science coming around to the point of offering a contemporary scientific framework for what some of the metaphysical thinkers like Rudolf Steiner and many others over the century have thought about of, you know, the multidimensional universe. My favorite cosmologist, the first interdisciplinary cosmologist, was Giorgio Bruno, who was burned at the stake in 1600 for, as a Catholic priest, writing a cosmology that looked at the truth at that point in time from all epistemologies, from all ways of knowing. And the church said, you got to have just one way of looking at it. And so he was burned at the stake. But what science has done now with string theory and the notion of, you know, the quantum plenum of space, a level of reality that is not visible yet, which obviously informs and forms that which is visible. So science has now come around to the notion that we are a multidimensional universe, but it has not given any has not put any meat on those bones, if I can use that metaphor. So what I've done in the, my cosmological perspective is to say, you know, let's look at some of the meat on those bones. And that's when we get into telepathy and remote viewing and precognition, and you get into the soul genome, which obviously is outside of the 4D time space that we experience here in between lives. And, you know, so it does mesh. I'm glad you mentioned that, because it really, you have to think of it in this multidimensional cosmological model.
And so many people have those subtle senses.
Absolutely. Well, we all have them to varying degrees, you know. It's a matter of whether we're open to them, whether we reinforce them or ignore them. That's the key, you know. Our both our religious culture and our scientific culture has deprecated these notions, has dismissed these notions or ridiculed them in many instances, and even in the history of the church, you know, punished people for having, it's of the devil, you know, it's of Satan to have these inner senses at work. And so we had a lot of women, you know, rounded up, for the most part women, some men, rounded up as witches and burned at the stake.
Oh, I know, that's terrible. And some people remember having been reincarnated from those times.
Well, absolutely. I've got a couple of cases where I think some of the physical evidence that appears in this lifetime includes stigmata that might be associated with various forms of torture and death in previous lifetimes. This is where you have the physical marks. You see, and this is what's very interesting, because these physical marks are carried forward in the soul genome, or in this information-rich DNA genome that we can talk about in popular terms. And so that is part of the legacy as well.
Now, there's increasing talk and evidence that we may actually have been created genetically by advanced beings.
Oh, yes. Well, that takes us in another direction, but it's part of this bigger picture, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I call my website The Bigger Picture, because we've got to encompass these different areas of new learning about the reality in which we're a part.
Mm-hmm.
Of which we're a part. Excuse my preposition there.
Okay.
The evidence is becoming multidisciplined at this point.
Uh-huh.
You know, we have the ancient text from the Bible, from the Sumerian, the Egyptian,
yeah.
from folk tales out of Africa, from Aboriginal and North American traditional stories. I mean, we have from around the world
a wealth of evidence.
I'm sorry?
A wealth of information.
A wealth of information. But in addition to those stories that describe this advanced being's intervention in human development, we now have genetics, which is getting very interesting because we have all of this so-called junk DNA that has a lot of DNA in it that seems to be left over, you know, from past generations, and we don't quite know where it came from and what it's all about.
Hmm.
And this, one of these days, I suspect, we'll be able to decipher some of these interspecies influences, whether it was a genetic manipulation, much as we do, you know, genetic manipulation today.
Right, right.
On Homo erectus 250,000 years ago that gave us Homo sapiens. Or whether it's actually miscegenation between other species that might have come here from other places and actually physically interbred with humans to add to the genetic mix.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect that, you know, one of these days, first of all, you have to have an idea that you're looking for something like that, which, of course, most mainstream genetics research doesn't encompass in its model.
Right.
But once we begin, you know, getting geneticists who are willing to look in these directions, we're likely to see a lot of evidence genetically, and we're seeing it in terms of the fossil record.
Mm.
We're seeing it in terms of linguistics and studies of language and dispersion of languages and cultures. So there's just so much evidence that, you know, we had a different kind of development than we have been taught, either by the religious and spiritual traditions are by the scientific tradition. So I'm out in the middle, and I'm in the middle and in nowhere. because none of the particular disciplines want to encompass some of my iconoclastic ideas. And
well, it seems that the society in general is opening up quite a bit to new ideas.
Well, I think so. I'm finding it's interesting. I'm finding when I just even talk about the reincarnation research idea now, I'm getting very interested responses from a lot of people that I would never have expected it before.
Mm, good.
And so, yeah, I think you're right. It's opening up. I think we realize that we don't know it all now.
Yes, we're starting to realize that, you know, maybe there is more out there, and it's time to open our minds a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
I had a question for you on, let's see here.
Gee, I'm sorry to let the white space just hang out there.
That's quite all right. I was looking through my notes to see which direction I wanted to go in, and one of the questions that I had was about the veil of forgetfulness. It seems that I'm having a veil of forgetfulness right now.
You are my case in point. And we're all our case in point. No, I know what you're getting at.
Yeah.
And my explanation for that is that just as we have in our daily living, and as our growing within this lifetime, you know, we lose memories from the minute before,
yeah.
from the day before, from the week before, from the year before.
Yeah.
You know, what happens, this brings us to the teleological question of, you know, where did humans come from and what are we? But humans are all conscious species, are really organisms that can tap into any aspect of consciousness because, mm-hmm. you know, we are of that whole. But in order to be an individual entity, we have to focus.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't focus on everything at once. And
right.
I know it.
Right.
And so just as I have to forget a lot of stuff that I did in the State Department or in the Navy or in my first marriage or when I lived in Oregon or, you know.
Yeah.
But I keep the essence of me.
Yeah, yeah.
Throughout this.
Yeah.
Well, the same thing happens in the reincarnation process. The essence of you is an integral organism that is consistent and transcendent over lifetimes.
Yeah.
In my view, that's what it is. And when you are newly born and newly beginning to find your vocabulary and so on, you still have enough of those fresh memories that you share them with people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Stevenson's work focused on. You know, children who had memories that their parents recognized as being connected to somebody else's lives in the past. But what his research showed, and I'm finding that's pretty true with the cases that I've looked at, by about age 8 or 9, you know, these memories are gone because you've taken the events of this lifetime have taken the space in your file, you know, in your memory file, and you forget it. And I think that's happened. In fact, I had an email today from person overseas saying, gee, you know, Dalai Lama said he doesn't have any memories of his past lifetime, and therefore that shows that, you know, that's we don't carry our memories forward. And I wrote this person back, and I said, well, the Dalai Lama doesn't remember them now, but when he was 2 and 3 years old, he remembered them. And I gave him a little piece that I have on the website about Dalai Lama's mother's memoirs, where she tells us the stories of what the Dalai Lama did when he was 2 and 3.
Oh, yeah.
And he obviously remembered he was talking about these people and knew them and knew what had happened before and where he had been.
And unless they put him through all those tests where he's supposed to pick out a certain object, and he always picked out the right object, which was, you know, something that belonged to the previous Dalai Lama.
Yeah, yeah. The story, it's an interesting story. The Dalai Lama's nephew and niece actually were responsible for this book because the niece wrote down the memories of the Dalai Lama's mother, that is, the niece's grandmother, for over a number of years before she died. And then the niece who was writing this down, all the notes, she died in an automobile accident. And then the brother, many years later, took all of her notes and put them together in a book that came out, you know, 7 or 8 years ago. But it's a marvelous piece of work because it gives us the pre-Dalai Lama perspective on the Dalai Lama. And it's very interesting, you know. The process that you just alluded to is not quite like the popular story.
Okay.
At least from the mother's point of view.
Tell us more.
Well, because it involves several visits.
Uh-huh.
It involves several kinds of encounters. It involves several levels of exchange between the little 2-plus-year-old Lamo at the time, L-H-A-M-O, Dondrup. So it's told from his mother's point of view, and she remembered some of the objects that he did, you know, relate to, but it wasn't quite the, according to her anyway, and I think I would trust her more than most others.
Right.
It was not quite the way it's described in popular stories today, you know, that this group of people came along and they had these objects and they set him down and asked him to look at them and he picked out the right one. It really was a several, there were three visits, for example, with the family by several people. There was interaction. These visits were separated over time. There were 16 people who were other people who had been identified as well as him. They got it down to sort of three finalists, and then there was, you know, then he was the final one. but it was just, it was a natural process, and what is so refreshing to someone like myself, who only wants to work with empirical data, in other words, something that people can see for themselves, or hear from themselves, or measure for themselves. In other words, extra-dimensional information in terms of psychic material or channel material or past life regression efforts to extract information. All that information, you know, cannot be verified by anybody else.
Right.
And so what you have to do is, if you want to take some of those clues, you then have to find evidence that you can corroborate between the two lifetimes to demonstrate that there is a real carry-forward there. And the Dalai Lama, the head of this great spiritual movement, was simply identified through the same process the reincarnation experiment is doing its work today, which is through empirical knowledge and talents and skills and so on.
Interesting.
So it's
Do you think that we ever escape from this wheel of life and death?
I'm sorry?
Do you think we ever escape from reincarnation totally, from the wheel of life and death?
Well, you know, we don't know that from empirical evidence. We know that the Buddhist tradition is that one did escape at a certain point after reaching a certain level of evolution of consciousness.
Mm.
And, of course, even in the times of Plato and that era, you still had the belief that, you know, we came around until we got it right and then we didn't come around again. And we also have a number of extra-dimensional sources now, advanced beings of one kind or the other who have spoken through channels or through psychic means.
Mm-hmm.
Indicating that, you know, there is this sort of graduation into another phase.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't think we can empirically satisfactorily pin it down, because what you've got are so many different stories, so many different interpretations.
Well, that's true.
But it would make sense, you know, that if we're talking about an entity engaged as a part of a species in an evolving process, that obviously at some point you would say graduate, as it were. You know, after we spend 12, 13, 15 years in a school, then, you know, we sort of graduate.
Right, right. It would make sense.
And so I suspect from a natural perspective that, you know, that it's part of an ongoing evolution, and probably it not only involves individuals, but species, you know, when species reach a level of evolution that you don't need that species anymore. It sort of grows into its own at another level.
Well, you know, a lot of people, I read a lot of channel material and information about these times, and it seems that there's a lot of consensus that say the Book of Revelations and Hopi and other indigenous prophecies and the Mayan calendar are all speaking about the evolution of man becoming possible, and that's some kind of evolutionary leap sometime around 2012. Do you find any kind of evidence for that in your research?
I was talking to a group of people a couple of nights ago, got into this discussion. I think we are projecting a lot on some astronomical data,
mm-hmm.
which is that, you know, the universe is continually going through a series of transitions, if you please. I mean, just as we go through from night to day and from spring to summer to fall to winter, you know, the universe, so 2012 in December, we're going to be, you know, having a transit in our galaxy, which obviously affects the energetics that are involved in, you know, the astrology phenomenon. I don't think there's any question that, you know, as energy beings, we are affected by the vectors of energy coming through us and around us as it shifts. But to then extrapolate from that, you know, to some particularly powerful shift on this little planet in this part of the universe seems to me highly unlikely. I think that we can set up what we know as a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right.
You know, by looking forward to this, and if enough people buy into it and say, boy, we're going to become a peaceful society in 2012, if the majority of the species comes to that point, you know, we will make it self-realized prophecy.
Well, you know, there's another one that...
But I think a lot of other beings, advanced beings, who are talking to us through channels and so on...
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
...are, you know, they're encouraging us. They're trying to help us to, I think, make progress. And I'm in several groups that receive that sort of material from one source or the other. And these are beings who are trying to be helpful. I think the thing that I'm concerned about is that the human tendency to depend on advanced beings goes way back to the time of the Anunnaki and the Anakim and the Elohim, you know, being involved in solving human problems, or at least ruling over humans and having great powers and technologies and so on. That psychological state of dependency, I think, is very prevalent today. And so I would hope that we could remind ourselves that we are getting good help and advice from other beings in other dimensions, but that we've got to get our own act together to decide where we're going as a society and as a planet.
Oh, absolutely. And then if we are to ever reach the point where we can relate to these extraterrestrials or advanced beings, it seems that we need to we need to be able to approach them not from a stage of reverence and worship, but as partners or as potential equals.
Absolutely. I use the lectures that I give sometimes on this phenomenon, I use the analogy of, you know, the colonized, lesser developed societies on planet Earth by more advanced, highly developed societies, and we look at the psychological impact of that colonization process, and it takes a long time for those who are enslaved or those who are colonized to overcome the psychological state of becoming dependent and subservient and cowed and fearful and worshipful and so on. And that's what our religions, of course, have done over the last couple of centuries. And it's going to take something for us to get out of that mode. And I think when we as a species are able to get out of that mode, more advanced beings will welcome us into that galactic community. I think at the state we're in right now, we're not ready for it.
It does seem that way. We're pretty caught up in you know, some very primitive behavior, and it's been going on for thousands of years.
A lot of people say, well, are we making any progress? And look at all the problems in the world. And I think we are making progress.
Yeah.
It's slow, you see. We like to we have short lives, and we like to think that everything will happen in our own life.
Yes, exactly.
But I think in terms of the species perspective, we are making progress. And in fact, just the planetary, using the Internet as the physical analogy. We are becoming more interconnected through our subtle senses, through our inner ways of knowing. So consciousness as a species, I think, is synthesizing, integrating, strengthening its feedback loops and so on in a way that, you know, I think we're making progress, but we certainly take
we have a long way to go. Are you there?
Yes.
You know, especially when we're still engaged in wars and enemies and, you know, finding others that we don't agree with, and we're doing an awful lot of damage to the planet, too, so...
No, we are. And you see that the conflicts that you referred to, the wars, and even in our own culture here, you know, we really are going through a cultural clash right now of worldviews. These clash of worldviews that are mutually exclusive are the underlying cause of the fragmentation at a political and economic and social level. And so we've somehow got to find a way to begin to transcend these worldviews, and I've been talking a lot about the notion of trying to have a third eye perspective so that we look. And that's why I'm encouraging people to do a self-assessment of their own worldviews, their underlying assumptions that hold their psyche together.
You have something on your website where
they can... Yeah, I do have a worldview self-assessment questionnaire. I welcome people to use that. Send it in to me, and I will send a little paper, you know, sort of describing the methodology and what I think it means.
Well, you know, we've just about run out of time. That's a good time to segue into you telling people how they can find, you know, to reiterate the website address so they can get there.
Right, okay. Well, there are two websites. One is my, you know, professional one, overall website. It's vonward.com. And then the reincarnation experiment one that I invite people also to take a look at is just reincarnationexperiment.org.
And your latest book is quite riveting. It's The Soul Genome, Science and Reincarnation. And it's really very interesting. I'm almost through it now, and it's really quite fun to explore this, you know, how this all works together. So I highly recommend it. And, Paul, you've been wonderful. I really thank you for being on the show tonight.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Went very quickly.
I know.
About halfway through.
I know. It just goes like a flash, doesn't it?
That's right. Well, thank you very much for the opportunity.
All right. Thanks again, Paul, and good night.
Good night.